It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we go now?
Yeah, a little false start there in the music. You know, it just wouldn't be a Saturday if I didn't press at least one button wrong.
There you go. Where are those missiles going to? when it says launch like that, don't press it.
Yeah, don't worry. Ronald Reagan said we can recall those.
Oh, okay.
All right. Got plenty for this week, so let's dive into the meat of the program. And starting out with the Port of Seattle and the PI.
Yeah, the PI finally ran an article on Friday that the port wants to levy $25 a day fee to small fishermen who sell fish off their boats at the fisherman's terminal. And evidently the port also wants to tear down the storage locker lofts that the fishermen use to store their gear. I think it's interesting that...
In other words, they do want to run them out of the area.
Yeah, even though this has been proposed for a little while, the PIs finally picked it up. It's good to see that somebody did. I didn't see it reported at all in the Times.
Oh, it actually was at the beginning of the week. Of a week before.
Was it?
Yeah.
That shows you what the delay is.
Well, the PI is a little. The folks at the PI are a little traumatized right now, so they're a little slow on the uptake.
With the new format.
They're busy with their resumes
staff.
Yeah.
But the port, I mean, when we look at that, I mean, the port's really looking at trying to push the small fishermen out and be able to get big fishing boats or other kinds of large vessels in there to pay big moorage fees for the port. And this comes in a year when last year the port had a lot of extra cash laying around, so much so that they gave a tax cut to taxpayers and decided not to up the rates at all because, you know, they couldn't spend all the money they'd collected. But here they're just, I think, it's not even an issue of greed. I think it's more just an issue of how can they drive more of these small fishermen out of business.
Yeah, ever since the Port of Seattle went into the waterfront real estate development business, they've basically had their eyes on the Fisherman's Terminal property and trying to redevelop it in a way that's more tourist-friendly, that's more friendly to large boats. And they've really been waging war on the small boats and small operators that depend on that moorage in order to make a living. And this is just the latest step in that. And unfortunately, the PI and the Times, both in their coverage, relied heavily on spokespeople for the port and really gave very short shrift to what the actual impact on the people who rely on this for a living.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Moving on, I believe it was this week that they discovered a weapons cache in Bellevue.
Yeah, actually, a person had bought the contents of a storage locker at auction when the original person who rented the locker didn't pay the rent on it. And when he opened up that storage locker, because the rental company didn't do that, they just auctioned off the contents. When the buyer opened up the locker, it contained all of this military-grade weapons that he wasn't sure was legal. So he placed a call to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and said, "Can you come down and take a look at this?" Well, when ATF agents showed up, they just about blew their tops. They'd never seen this much stuff in one place. They searched about three or four other places that were owned by the former owner of the locker, and they came up with a total of 37 machine guns, including M14s, M16s, and Sten guns, which can fire about 500 rounds a minute.
In other words, he had so much of this stuff that he lost track of one of his lockers.
Right. He had 12 silencers, 2 grenade launchers, and then 60-plus high-explosive grenades. Several pounds of C4 plastic explosives. So what comes to mind, you know, a lot of what's being debated about this is, you know, why did this guy have this stuff? Was he a right-wing guy involved in paramilitary activity? Shouldn't he be considered a domestic terrorist,
yeah,
et cetera?
The ATF spokespeople were saying, even though anti-government literature was found in this guy's possession also, and, you know, right-wing paramilitary anti-government literature, he's not a domestic terrorist. No. If he were, say, Muslim and had an Arabic-sounding name, then he would be a domestic terrorist. But he's a white guy, so it's all okay.
Yeah, in spite of the fact that just owning this stuff can get him at least 10 years in prison, you know, obviously the ATF doesn't consider him...
Probation. He'll get probation.
No, right. The ATF doesn't consider him a domestic terrorist. I think the more important question is not why did he have the stuff, but how did he get the stuff? And I just want to point out that when you have two major wars going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, it can be hard sometimes for the military to keep track of where all of their equipment is going, especially when you have underpaid employees shipping it around. So my guess is that somebody was siphoning off, some C4 here, a couple of machine guns there, and selling them on the black market. Usually that happens. Usually that happens abroad in black markets in other countries. But this is a case where the black market was operating here at home. And I just wanted to point that out, that this is something you can expect when you've got two long-term wars being fought in two countries.
Well, and I don't think the actual items they found are that unusual, to here in the States, that people have them. I think it was the quantity that was so disturbing.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Well, I think just the availability of it now.
Yeah.
Well, I just need them to hunt deer.
Well, speaking of
speaking of
hunting deer, there was a state legislature weighed in on hunting this week.
More annals of the wild, wild west here. The state legislature. State legislature introduced a bill to set the minimum age for teenagers to hunt without adult supervision at age 14. Currently, there is no minimum. The bill was proposed by Democratic Representative Brian Blake of Aberdeen, and it's interesting. The state Fish and Wildlife Department looked at the bill, and they said, well, we recommend it be age 16. The Washington Trails Association said, 16? What are you talking about? It should be age 18. When a person becomes an official adult. I want to point out too that this is all coming up because of an incident this summer when a 14-year-old shot and killed a hiker on the Olympic Peninsula, thinking that she was a bear. And this was while he was under the supervision of his 16-year-old brother. So I don't think either age 14 or age 16 is sufficient for someone to be out with a weapon in their hands hunting near hiking trails.
Well, I mean, you grew up in rural areas. You know perfectly well that especially for teenage boys, that it's very, very common, regardless of what the law says, for adults to say, oh, my kid needs to know how to handle a firearm and just send them out there. The question of what this law would do is it requires culpability. It requires that the parent or guardian be responsible if anything happens.
Mm-hmm.
And that, unfortunately, has really been missing.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, it's true in rural areas, kids start handling guns usually at an early age, but it's always incumbent on the parent to make sure that the kid is well trained and that they're responsible, that they know what they're doing. When you put them out in the woods, without any adult supervision, it's just not wise to not have an adult there to grab the gun, lift it out of his hands, and say, "What are you doing? Look first, shoot next."
Yeah.
All right, moving on. The WASL days are numbered, it appears.
Yes, the brand new superintendent of public education for the state of Washington, Randy Dorn, who was elected in November to replace Terry Bergeson, who is a big, big fan of the WASL. He campaigned, Dorn did, on abolishing the WASL, and glory be, he has actually followed through on his pledge, although he was also in the state legislature last week complaining that his $120,000 a year salary was too low for him to live on, which... talk about being politically tone deaf. Anyway, the WASL looks like it is history. It's being replaced by a couple of different tests, one for elementary students and one for older students. So you will still have standardized tests because, of course, they're still required by federal law. But the WASL, which has been justly maligned by a lot of different parent and teacher groups over the last few years, it looks like that will be phased out by next year. And it couldn't come as a moment too soon because it's good news.
All right. Then that takes us on to national. And
anything happened this week?
I think there was an inauguration for somebody new in the White House.
Yeah.
Nah. Hey. Oh, sorry.
Anyway. Yeah, there was massive attention paid to Obama's inauguration. So much that it was a little bit surreal for me. I'd never seen that this many people want to watch an inauguration, either to go and see it in person or to watch it on TV or in a historic first, millions of people watching it live as streaming video on the internet, which is how I saw it. And it really is, I think, because it is a historic first, he's the first African-American president, but I think also because it's the end of the Bush era, as my sister said when she called me up later that day, she said, well, I just finished watching the inauguration and I saw Bush get on the helicopter. Bye.
Yeah, people were actually singing this theme song to him as the helicopter was lifting off, which I don't know whether that was, you know, disrespectful or hilarious or some combination thereof, but... Mm-hmm. It is the end of the Bush era, and it was, you know, really psychically as though a fog were lifting. I mean, I talked to several people who were in D.C. who say and I've been to different inaugurations in the past, the atmosphere for this one, the crowds for this one, and the sense of participation for this one, and the sense that there was public ownership of this, and that, the inauguration crowds and, the celebrations that were being done by people that looked like America. I was in D.C. in 2001 for the first Bush inauguration, and the people that were celebrating were all wearing cowboy boots or furs. I mean, it wasn't quite like that this time. And, you know, regardless of what you want to say about President Obama's public policies, and, you know, some will be good and some will be bad, and we'll probably be fairly critical over the next 4 or 8 years at different points, but the country really needed that sort of very palpable sense of closing that particular book and moving on from the Bush presidency, and having a sense of hope and forwardness, and having the sense that there's somebody in charge who actually, whether or not he can solve the tremendous array of problems that face the country and the world, or even, you know, take helpful steps towards solving them, at least he understands them and is reasonably intelligent and is not simply there to pay off his corporate cronies.
Yeah.
It's a big, big change and a very welcome one.
Yeah, and I think if the former President Bush's era is going to be associated with anything, it's going to be two things. It's going to be the disastrous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's going to be the worst economic crisis that I think probably this country has ever seen, are going to both be associated with George W. Bush. That said, I think people were at the inauguration and watching the inauguration with the hope that Obama is going to provide some kind of explanation or some kind of leadership when it comes to those two issues. And I was really listening to his inauguration address with an ear for what he was going to say in regards to the economy. And I was pretty disappointed, actually, to hear him make a statement that expressed his belief that the free markets would heal themselves and all we needed to do was pull together and work a little bit harder to make that happen, really made me think, okay, wait a minute here. What you're saying, that's a code phrase for we are not going to nationalize our banks at a time when that's probably what needs to be done. And secondly, saying that that you're not really going to talk about the real cause of the problem, which is not that we haven't all been working hard over the last 8 years, because many, many of us have been working very hard to try to keep up, but that the real cause of the problem is just greed, out-and-out greed by a small group of people who are the shareholders and CEOs of these corporations who pushed for deregulation and pushed for doing these risky financial things.
Greed and amorality, because it's not just that they were greedy, it's that they didn't care who they hurt along the way.
Right, right.
All right. Obviously, right after that, he had his first day where he was busy signing.
Well, there were a number of things that have happened in the first few days. Most of them fairly good. Just as a brief overview of the things that he's done, the Bush administration froze the late Bush administration regulatory actions, many of which were attempts to essentially provide windfalls for their corporate buddies on the way out the door. He also restored the Freedom of Information Information Act and Presidential Records Act, adding transparency to the executive branch that we haven't seen in a number of years, lifted the global gag rule on providing aid to family planning clinics and whatnot where abortion can even be mentioned, let alone provided, froze the Military Commissions Act, which was looking at providing quote-unquote trials to various people in Guantanamo. There will be 120 days of review for that. Also pledged to close Guantanamo, although the exact mechanics of how that's going to happen are still open to question. Also met with advisors on plans for how to withdraw from Iraq. Also made his first calls domestically within the government apparatus to the State Department and saying that diplomacy is back, which...
And that the CIA can't torture people anymore.
That the CIA
adhere to the Army Field Manual.
Yeah, they have to. and then his first call internationally, also to the leader of Fatah on the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, which is a mixed bag. It signals that he wants to pay attention to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but if he had really wanted to make headway in that, he wouldn't have called the U.S. Israeli puppet. He would have called Hamas.
Well, he would have called them both, I think.
Yeah, he would have had to call them both. Obviously.
To get some resolution in the Middle East, you have to have the Palestinians united. You can't have them fighting each other endlessly.
Yeah. Yeah, although whether Abbas actually has much of a constituency,
much representation, certainly
outside,
not in Gaza. Yeah,
outside what he's been paid to get by the army of thugs that the U.S. and Israel hired for him, is another question. But in any event, a lot of and I want to talk a little bit when we get to international news also about some developments in Pakistani policy over the past few days. But by and large, you really can't complain that much about what's being done in the first few days. He's taken a number of steps that were long overdue.
All right, and Congress, did they do anything?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they were busy too. They passed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which is an act that overturns a really horrible Supreme Court decision that, of course, was enabled by the newly conservative Supreme Court, including the justices that Bush nominated and the Democrats rolled over for. But they have turned around and made it legal once again for employees to sue over gender pay discrimination. Very interestingly, the Republicans almost all voted against it. No, let me rephrase that. The male Republicans voted 37-1 against it. The women Republican senators all voted for it. So when you hear Republican senators talking about, well, this isn't an issue of patriarchy, this is an issue of principle and the rights of employers and yada yada yada, that doesn't explain why the women Republican senators all voted for it.
Yeah.
All right. Takes us over then to this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week was another week in which banks reported more record losses for the fourth quarter. Bank of America, last week reported a record loss, they forced out Merrill Lynch CEO John Thayne because of the $15.31 billion fourth quarter loss at Merrill Lynch. Now, just to give you some comparison, again, when Bank of America jumped in and decided to buy up Merrill Lynch last year, Merrill Lynch was valued at the time at $19.4 billion for purposes of the merger. And when a company that's valued at $19.4 billion reports a $15.31 billion loss for one quarter of 1 year, that's giving you some clue that maybe you made a bad purchase.
Epic fail.
yes. So, of course, someone had to take the blame for that, and John Thayne got pushed out. But, Merrill had announced in late last year in December millions of dollars in bonuses for its upper-level executives just before the merger was complete. So I'm guessing it's also a little bit of revenge as well to say, look, Thayne, you guys had a record poor year, and you're still paying yourself bonuses. Somebody has to fall on his sword, and it's going to be you.
Yeah, that's a pretty comfortable sword they're following on.
yeah. And this is after years of being one of the most highest paid executives on Wall Street. And then, of course, once another more evidence that the economic problems are not just here at home, they're global. Royal Bank of Scotland, one of the largest banks in the UK, became the second UK bank to fall under government control, which means that the British government has gone a long ways towards nationalizing much of the British financial system. Royal Bank of Scotland, after announcing that last year's losses could total $41.3 billion for the year, promptly lost about two-thirds of its value on the stock market on Monday in one day's trading. And, of course, in order to keep the bank from completely failing, the British government had to step in and take it over. That loss, by the way, $41.3 billion, is the largest ever for a British company in history. And we talk about the U.S., you think history of a couple of hundred years, you know. But British economic history goes much, much, much further back. And then, of course, this week as well, Freddie Mac said it's going to need another $30 to $35 billion in government aid, in addition to the nearly $14 billion they've received already through the Troubled Asset Relief Program to bail them out. Their losses for the third quarter, this is just for the third quarter, were $25.3 billion. And just to remind folks, the government, the U.S. government, took them over in September. So, of course, they haven't yet announced their fourth quarter losses. But when they come out and say we need $30 to $35 billion, you can guess that that's about what their losses were, and that the losses are just getting worse and worse with as each quarter goes on. So it's become pretty clear that the government bailouts are not helping. And that the fact that the Treasury is not keeping track of what banks are using the money for, that the government's not taking a controlling interest in these banks, so we have no clue of whether or not they're continuing their same bad old habits of making bad loans, managing their money poorly, buying worthless derivatives and other risky investments. So the question is what to do about this. Of course, the Treasury should be taking some control of these banks. That for any bank that gets bailout money, the U.S. government should get some kind of controlling interest. And then, of course, you have to address the housing problem. You have to address it on Main Street. You can't be doing it all on Wall Street. So there has to be something done to help people who are losing their houses, most particularly. And it's nice to see that the Democrats have proposed a bill that would give judges the right to modify mortgages in bankruptcy court. That's something that has to be done, something the Republicans and the banking industry are resisting as much as they can. And of course, the third thing that has to happen is you got to re-regulate, and you got to do it quickly. This is something we've been saying for over a year now, and nothing's happened. And you know, with all the stuff that Obama has done in his first few days in office, I would have hoped he would have taken more steps in that direction, but he hasn't yet.
It'll be interesting to see with the Obama administration's loosening of the FOIA laws this week.
Freedom of Information Act, yeah.
Right, if that will affect the requests that have been going in for trying to get documents out of the Federal Reserve, which had been blocked so far.
Mm-hmm. About money that the Federal Reserve has poured into some of these some of these companies.
So I know they haven't been, Blomberg hasn't been getting anywhere with their legal challenge on that so far.
Mm-hmm.
All right, anything else on that?
No, let's move
on. Okay, moving on to international and updates on what is happening in Gaza.
Yeah, there's a ceasefire in Gaza now, but also reports that are coming out of some very troubling new weapons that the Israeli army was using on the civilian population of Gaza.
Field testing.
And we're just, except there are no fields in Gaza. It's the most densely populated area on the planet.
Probably.
It is. Mm-hmm. It very much is with the refugee camps and whatnot. But particularly a new weapon called the DIME or DIME, the Dense Inert Metal Explosives. This is a particularly nasty weapon that is designed to kill and maim civilian populations. When detonated, a DIME device expels a blade of charged tungsten dust that burns and destroys everything within a 4-meter radius. One doctor there was reporting widespread but previously unseen abdominal injuries that appear minor at first but degenerate within hours, causing multi-organ failure and a gruesome, fairly painful death. what happens is that it takes these shards of micro dust, of metal dust, and embeds them, dozens of them, in internal organs and causes organ failure within the different organs.
And
you're also seeing,
keep
because
in mind, we're not talking about Hamas fighters here. We're talking largely about
women, children, yeah,
old people.
Yeah. You're also seeing an unusual number of multiple amputations because it explodes from the ground up, so you get the shearing off of arms and legs. Mm-hmm. It's really pretty despicable, and this is something that again is targeted at a civilian population. These are not folks that are launching rockets across the border. These are people who are, you know, trapped in refugee camps with no place to flee to, being in the line of fire.
You think about the development of these anti-personnel weapons, and I think of the people that we send into battle from our side, these young men, some of them not even men really yet, and what we send them into. Can you imagine anybody having to face something like that, whether it's women or children, civilians, someone who's a 19-year-old boy, you know?
Yeah.
It's just incredible. So, after that, I was going to talk a little bit about some of the political fallout of what's happened in Gaza. Israel stopped its attack just hours before the inauguration, which I think was a sign, really, that they were trying to get in their last licks before the Bush administration left.
And you know that the Bush administration had green-lighted this whole invasion months ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was very much time to be gotten in before the Bush administration left office.
Right, and the stated goal, Israel's stated goal, which was to disrupt the flow of weapons through the tunnels from Egypt into Gaza, was not only not met, but I'm sure probably not even close. I mean, there were reporters on the Egyptian side of the border saying that the flow of goods through the tunnels was not even interrupted during the fighting and continued well after. And those few tunnels that were damaged were being quickly cleared when the dust had settled.
Yeah. Or rebuilt, as the case may be.
The case may be. And there are many in Gaza, as well as many people who watch the situation in Israel and the Gaza Strip, who say that the Israeli attack has not only not weakened Hamas, it may have actually strengthened them politically and weakened Fatah, because Mahmoud Abbas, the head of Fatah, was unable to do anything to really make Israel pull back or to get any kind of a resolution out of the problem. It really showed how little power he has. And because Hamas has continued to be the only group that has been able to provide any kind of assistance, really, to civilians in Gaza, it's really probably strengthened them politically more than anything and divided the Palestinians even more than they were in the past.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
Let's move on to Afghanistan.
Yeah, Hamid Karzai may be on the way out. I was kind of interested to hear that Hillary Clinton called the Afghan government during her confirmation hearing. She called the Afghan government a narco state plagued by limited capacity and widespread corruption. I would call this just a little dose of reality after the Bush administration, that she was basically responding to the fact that last October a leaked U.S. intelligence report had named Karzai's brother a major narco trafficker, and there is no doubt that the Afghan government has been involved in a lot of corrupt policies and practices. The NATO Secretary General wrote in a Washington Post article, quote, "The basic problem in Afghanistan is not too much Taliban, it's too little good governance. So I think we're going to see that the Obama administration is distinctly not impressed with Hamid Karzai, and he is on the way out.
Yeah. Besides which, we're also seeing some changes in U.S. policy toward Pakistan in the first few days. Yesterday, two remote airstrikes killing 20 more people in Pakistan. We've seen also that the U.S. signaling, and Hillary Clinton during her confirmation hearing, signaling that the Obama administration would up civilian aid to Pakistan. Under Bush, there was $6 billion in military aid, with almost no civilian aid to the population there, and then also that it was going to condition military aid on whether Pakistan went after the Taliban, Al Qaeda, and Osama bin Laden while they were there.
All right, events.
Yeah, just one very quickly. Tomorrow, Sunday, there will be a protest of the school closure plan. That'll be at 2 o'clock, starting at TT Minor and marching past Nova, both of which are slated for closure, and going to the Garfield Community Center, TT Minor at 17th and Union, the Community Center at 23rd and Cherry. That's at 2 o'clock tomorrow.
All right, and then there's the noontime event at Westlake Park today for Gaza.
Yes, that's been going on every Saturday at noon for the past several weeks now.
All right, talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found online at www.eatthestate.org, or you can find us around town in places where you find free periodicals.